Ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure to introduce, or rather reintroduce, Dr. Cedric Thornbury, who this evening is going to deliver the second of his three 50th UN anniversary lectures on the development of peacekeeping. I know that most of you will have heard his masterly insider's overview of 40 years plus of peacekeeping on Tuesday, so I won't repeat all the introductions that were made then, but for those who were not here on that occasion, I should say that we are particularly privileged to be able to welcome Cedric back to the LSE this week and next. He was a member, a lecturer in the law department here in the 1960s and indeed the 1970s before he went to work in the UN. He's recently been appointed an honorary fellow of the school, and he is a former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations. But for our purposes this evening and next Monday and indeed on Tuesday, what is very relevant is that he has a unique experience, a practitioner's experience, in UN peacekeeping. He's been a peacekeeper in the Middle East, in Cyprus, in Namibia, and in former Yugoslavia. And you'll recall, those of you who were here on Tuesday, that he finished up his overview of the background to UN peacekeeping by the entirely new departure which was reached with the setting up of the UN force in Namibia, in which he was deeply implicated as director of the Office of the Special Representative throughout. And he was also deeply implicated in the sense that he was responsible for setting up the UN operation in former Yugoslavia from early 1992 as Deputy Chief of Mission and Director of Civil Affairs. And so those two particular experiences give him a wealth of expertise on which to draw in continuing his personal analysis of the development of UN peacekeeping. And I'm very glad to welcome you, Cedric, for the second lecture.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, as I said at the end of my last lecture, this one would be entitled Only the Odd-Numbered World Wars Start in Sarajevo. And I would like to emphasize that I am still a staff member of the United Nations, and what I am expressing tonight and throughout these lectures is a purely personal point of view, and it is, on the whole, a practitioner's point of view. I haven't yet been able to stand back far enough, perhaps, to be able to abstract to the extent that I would like to be able. The task of the United Nations in Namibia was to ensure a transition in about a year from a brutal border liberation war to free and fair democratic elections for a constituent assembly, a democratic, human rights-based constitution, and independence. Along the way, we were to bring about a ceasefire, the confinement of troops to base, the withdrawal of the South African army, the return of Namibians from their worldwide diaspora, the repeal of repressive or discriminatory legislation, the release of political prisoners, and then the registration of all qualified electors, the drafting of appropriate election laws embodying an appropriate election system. The legislation, in fact, took months of legal and constitutional wrangling to agree, and the holding of transparently democratic elections. For some of this, the UN was directly responsible. For other parts, the South Africans were. For their administration would remain in Namibia until independence. But each of their public or political acts was taken under the supervision of the Secretary-General's special representative, Marty Ahtisaari, who had to be, quote, satisfied, unquote, each step of the way. This was the plan which the so-called Western Contact Group had drawn up in 1977-8 with the concurrence of the African frontline states, South Africa and SWAPO, and with input from the UN. South Africa insisted on remaining during the interim period. On balance, especially after the change in South African presidency from P.W. Botha to F.W. de Klerk, halfway through the process, this was probably the most practical solution, though many serious problems were met at every point throughout the process. The degree of supervision in most fields was extremely close, especially in the electoral and human rights areas, and in some, the South Africans finally wilted under the sheer pressure to which they were subjected. We moved throughout at a brisk gallop in accordance with the timetable, and at times ran everybody off their feet. In fact, in general, the South Africans cooperated closely and effectively with the UN, with a few dramatic exceptions, especially in the security and intelligence fields. And on the night of Namibian independence, the ceremony was attended not only by President de Klerk, but also by his very recent prisoner, about to be President Mandela. The writing had been on the wall for several months, and there had been, as I mentioned on Tuesday, intimations that a successful Namibian process might be one of the key elements in the solution of the complex problem of South Africa. It was at least a major confidence-building block. Each stage was completed on time and to the UN's satisfaction, though elements of the South African security forces were perpetually trying to throw spanners into the works right up to almost the eve of the election, when they discovered what we rapidly demonstrated were forged messages which they said they had intercepted between some of our frontline people and the battalion at headquarters, but we were able to demonstrate that this was clearly not our handwriting, and we left it to South Africa to draw their own conclusions. And within an hour or two, the foreign minister, who had rather foolishly gone out of limb, had to retract. Consequence was that the eve of elections was marked by a sort of carnival atmosphere. We also became the object of attention of the so-called Civil Cooperation Bureau, about which some of you may know, certainly those of you who come from Southern Africa, which was a state terrorist organization which carried out political assassinations in Namibia during the transition period, and whose activities began to be unveiled just as UNTAG, UN Transition Assistance Group, finished. There were problems all the way, and at times it was touch and go. But the worst thing that happened certainly was that which occurred on the first day of the mission, the 1st of April 1989, when SWAPO fighters came across the border from Angola, probably to establish bases in northern Namibia. The heaviest fighting of the 20-year-old border war took place in the first weeks of what was supposed to have been the peace following a ceasefire. We were faced with the choice of permitting some South African forces to leave their bases, to which they had been confined as of midnight on that night, to repel the SWAPO infiltrators, all of whom should clearly have been confined north of the 16th parallel in Angola? Or have South Africa, as Pik Botha threatened volubly on that night, and in the presence of Mrs. Thatcher, who happened to be there, or have South Africa tear up the peace agreement because of what they alleged to be their opponent's unforgivable bad faith? We had no troops to speak of on the ground at the time because of delays in the authorizing process by the UN's legislative bodies. It took more than a month to get the peace process back on track. It required a miracle, a man-made miracle, called the Joint Commission, to which I shall return. Meanwhile, several hundred young Namibians and South Africans had lost their lives in a futile conflict, and some dreadful things were done in the spirit of atrocity in which much of that war had been conducted. It nearly destroyed the operation before it was even breathing. And the events of the 1st of April cast a very long shadow. Indeed, I would say it has not wholly dissipated in Southern Africa even today. However, just 7 months later, the Namibian people voted with great enthusiasm and moving determination in unquestionably free and fair elections, with a turnout of more than 97% of the registered electorate. And a few months later, perhaps even as important, their elected representatives finalized a practical and democratic constitution which had been drafted by consensus among people who recently had been divided by a dreadful civil war. For its part, UNTAG finished its mandate under time and under budget, which, as the General Assembly remarked, in itself made it unprecedented. It was an operation which broke a great deal of new ground and from which numerous lessons could have been learnt. Yet the UN operation in Namibia, though sophisticated politically and in the complexity of its mandate and organization, had some quite special characteristics. At top weight, it numbered around 8,000, of whom about half were military. No precise analogies should, in my opinion, ever be drawn between one mission and another, although the Namibia operation appeared to be very different to any that had gone before. It did, however, confirm much of the experience gained by the previous 16 operations and, indeed, in some respects, as I shall try to show, took it further. First, the Namibia operation showed, I think, above all, how important it is that peacemaking and peacekeeping be intimately connected. It was extremely close in regard to Namibia. Not only the special representative, but the senior members of his team, including the force commander, were engaged at one time or another in the negotiating process which eventually brought about the settlement which UNTAG implemented. Peacemakers in this way can be informed about local conditions and about what is feasible and practical. Peacekeepers can understand more precisely the interests of the parties and what their bottom lines are. For, as one would think should be obvious, a mission on the ground with a political mandate must conduct negotiations involving constant decision-making every day it is in place. In the Namibia case, the peacemaking entity was a little diffuse at times. I mentioned already the five nations of the Western Contact Group, the seven frontline states in Nigeria, the OAU, together with the UN. After emplacement, its functions were largely taken over by the Joint Commission, founded by the Brazzaville Agreement of December 1988, of Angola, Cuba, South Africa, the US, and USSR, with Namibia represented by its chief South African executive, and with the United Nations present also through either Ahtisaari or myself, or both. Now, from the vantage point of 1995, that is not a very strange grouping. But I must ask you to cast your minds back to the situation which we were looking at in the late 1980s. And this was indeed a truly remarkable grouping of states which had worked very closely together over a period of 2 or 3 years with constant personnel at a very senior level, ministerial, permanent secretary kind of level. And they had learned to understand each other, to understand where the other's problems were, to understand where each of them was coming from, and had learned to appreciate the extent to which each other could be trusted. This was a remarkable expedient, and Alan James, in his very interesting book on peacekeeping, has actually pointed out some of the unique qualities of the Joint Commission. But I think that had it not been for the intensive work of the Joint Commission and the spirit of mutual trust that had developed among these rather unlikely collaborators, the Namibian operation would have become a fiasco in its first few weeks due to those tragic events of the 1st of April, which were not put an end to until several weeks into April, indeed early May. I had the impression that the Security Council was perhaps not entirely happy with the role that the Joint Commission had assumed for itself. They possibly felt that it was usurping its functions. But those directly involved in the process were very content. The Joint Commission could deliver quickly all the parties, and it avoided rhetoric and bombast. Second, the planning of the Namibian operation had many special features. There was ample time to plan because of implementation delays, 10 years. There was ample time to do that. The team that would implement the mandate had been selected for more than a decade and came together whenever negotiations were reactivated. Some of its members had substantial knowledge of Namibia and its circumstances. It is a good military maxim that he who plans should do, and that was the principle which underlay the senior management style of the UN Transition Assistance Group in Namibia. It stressed, and this was the style of Ahtisaari, it stressed individual responsibility. Not many missions can have these kinds of advantage. But the lesson, I think, is that planning to be effective must be fully informed, timely, and responsible. And as the military know, and repeatedly say, time spent on reconnaissance is rarely wasted. The UN had no specialist planning capability at that time, and one of the mission's last recommendations was that this should be remedied without any further delay. But I'm afraid it has taken several years, and I'm not entirely certain that we have yet achieved a satisfactory solution. A third lesson that every peacekeeper has engraved on his or her heart, and I'm glad to emphasize her as well, because in Namibia it was our proud boast that we almost achieved, for the first time in a peacekeeping operation, parity between men and women professionals in the field. It was the first time we'd ever really been able to bring on board a lot of highly skilled and experienced UN professionals. Women, and we deployed them in very senior positions throughout the mission area. But the lesson is about logistics. While a UN mission may have moral authority and political legitimacy, it will not long survive if it has no communications, transport, food, or shelter. It constantly amazes me how often one has to emphasize that logistics are the source of most vital things in peacekeeping, including much of the authority of the mission. Thus, despite all the Secretary General's dire warnings in the immediate pre-implementation period in 1989 about the need for adequate lead times, both Security Council and General Assembly, I'm sorry to say, did not comply with them. And in the circumstances, we found ourselves in a dreadfully difficult position with just a lead time of just over 3.5 weeks. Fourth point is that the mission was multifunctional and multi-component and led by a civilian special representative. All the elements of this mission were expected to support the political objectives of the mission in accordance with the special representative's decisions. This required detailed coordination at all levels, central, regional, local, with each component nevertheless respecting the other's lines of command, designated tasks, and expertise. With many more multi-component missions in prospect, the question of coordination, which goes to the heart of a mission's efficiency and morale, was of the highest priority. Nor can one totally avoid questions of personality. How do I put this? Few United Nations missions that I have seen have been led by special representatives of the caliber which the now President of Finland showed when he was special representative in Namibia. The fifth point that I want to make is that UNCIVPOL, the United Nations Civilian Police, were reinvented for UNTAG. They were very successful, a key to the mission's overall effectiveness. Their main task was to minimize intimidation and to neutralize the repressive and discriminatory conduct of the Southwest African Police and thus advance and protect the human rights of all Namibians. The likely importance of UNCIVPOL in future operations which had a human rights, reconciliation, or electoral function was evident from that time. Despite UNCIVPOL's success in Namibia, it was clear that in the fields of training, operational planning, systematization of practice, logistical organization, there is a great deal still to be done to make UNCIVPOL fully effective element in a peacekeeping operation. In many respects, the police in Namibia were one of the operational arms of the political side of the mission, and the implications of this had to be thought through fully. It took a long time for this to be digested, and I'm not sure even now that it has been fully understood. Sixth point is that UNTAG, the UN Transition Assistance Group, was the first operation to combine peacekeeping with electoral supervision. Most of the criteria used to ensure that the elections were free and fair had, frankly, to be invented as the mission went along. While it is clear that no single system will be best under all conditions, the UN was at the time rather vulnerable in Namibia because of, at that time, the lack of expertise which existed in the organization in respect of democratic elections. This should have been and has been remedied, and the UN has since frequently been of assistance under the authority, usually of the General Assembly, in elections held in other parts of the world, not only in tandem with peacekeeping operations. Seventh, UNHCR, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, was responsible for the repatriation process, which was a central aspect in restoring normality in Namibia prior to the elections. The relationship between UNHCR, which is a program of the, well, broadly speaking, is a program of the United Nations, and the UN itself, was close and worked very well. This was also a first of its kind and deserved close study, which I know UNHCR carried out. Other comparable operations have since built on this initial experience. Cambodia and Mozambique in particular saw much greater and in some ways more difficult repatriation exercises. In Cambodia, I understand that 370,000 people, 370,000 people were brought back by the UN to their country. In Mozambique, the figure by this summer will have been a staggering 1.5 million Mozambicans. whom the United Nations will have returned subsequent to the settlement which they have been able to achieve in Mozambique. If one thinks of the tide of human misery and happiness that that indicates, I find this a very moving achievement. 8, for the first time in peacekeeping, public information became a major theme. This was not only because of the then unprecedented amount of world interest in the process. We accredited more than 1,500 journalists by UNTAG in the course of a year. That was overwhelmingly the largest interest that the press had shown in any previous operation. In contrast, when I left Yugoslavia, or in any event after 2 years, we had accredited 5,000 journalists in Yugoslavia. But there's nothing between Yugoslavia and Namibia. It was perceived by UNTAG that active dissemination of information to the people about the objectives of the mission was a basic necessity of the process. While the objectives of the Namibian operation made the need for public information rather evident, it seemed clear that a revised approach to public information on the part of peacekeeping missions in general was necessitated. This has regretfully been only slowly acted upon, though in both Yugoslavia and in Cambodia, the new approach was, up to a point, implemented. We had some difficulties in Yugoslavia because we could not get staff. Thus, summarizing the UNTAG operation, it was a particularly innovative mission, even though some of its activities had been foreshadowed in earlier peacekeeping operations. It was seen at the time as having been very successful, an exemplar of a new form of peacekeeping in which civilians and police and military and humanitarian agencies and logisticians would work in an integrated or at least closely coordinated manner to achieve much broader aims than had been true of peacekeeping in the past. It also caught popular imagination. For the first time, a UN peacekeeping operation was conducted under the spotlights of world attention, and it was, probably correctly, seen as the first step towards a wider process of change and peaceful settlement in southern Africa as a whole. One had the impression at the time, and here I'm being very subjective and impressionistic, one had the impression that many people throughout the world were very happy to see an incontrovertible smash hit UN success. There really is, I believe, a huge potential reservoir of support for the United Nations throughout the world. And yet the change which the UNTAG operation indicated was not radical, but evolutionary. It built on the lessons and characteristics of earlier peacekeeping. It was the times which were radical. Because in that very same remarkable November week, in which the Namibian people, in an orderly and constitutional way, reached out for their freedom by exercising their votes in free and fair elections, the people of Berlin, with their bare hands, in some cases, tore down the wall, which had been the symbol of their oppression. These things happening exactly simultaneously with one another. Thereafter, it seemed to us in Windhoek that half the world's diplomatic corps had received instructions to find out from us the magic secret which had enabled Namibia to achieve radical change by peaceful UN-controlled means. What was the formula, they said. We told them it was valid for Namibia only, non-transferable, not for export, and that if we had our time over again, we would not do it the same way, because we could see how many aspects could have been improved. However, Namibia showed how fertile a route the plant called peacekeeping could be. Provided good care was taken to respect some quite basic principles, the matrix could be developed and shaped to fulfill many functions. The first fruits of a new confidence on the part of the UN and in the UN showed themselves in enhanced activity in Central America. Initially with ONU then, the UN Observer Group for the Verification of Elections in Nicaragua, set up in this case by the Secretary General, the first UN operation to monitor elections in an independent country. Its role was crucial in achieving acceptance for the subsequent peaceful handover of authority by the Sandinistas, and was quickly followed by ONUV in Haiti, which was established by the General Assembly. In November 1990, the Security Council created ONUCA, the UN Observer Group in Central America, to observe and verify regional peacemaking agreements, and in May 91 established ONUSAL. ONUSAL, the UN observer mission in El Salvador, had as its principal function the monitoring of agreements between the government and opposition, relating inter alia to the reduction of armed forces, training and monitoring of new police forces, and the maintenance of human rights. These Central American missions were very successful, and especially in their focus upon human rights, took the Namibian initiative even further. And I would add that, again, I think the point that I made earlier about the quality of a special representative was evident in Central America. In Alvaro de Soto, we had an outstanding controller of these operations. What was specially significant, however, was that the mandates of these operations took them well into the peacemaking area by giving them roles which went close to the core of underlying bases of instability. Implementation sought areas of possible consensus between the parties and then set out to broaden these, consolidating what was in some cases not much more than, I think diplomatically one might say, an inchoate desire for peaceful solutions among the people. The UN's involvement in ex-Yugoslavia began with the deployment of a group of military observers in January 1992. This was followed by the establishment of UNPROFOR on the 21st of February 1992 and the arrival of its command group in Belgrade on the 8th of March 1992. Prior to this, a good officers mission led by former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance had eventually been able to develop an agreement somewhat unconvincingly endorsed by Yugoslav and Croatian governments relating to the Serb-held areas of Croatia, divided into three UN-protected areas. We subsequently divided them once again so that we had four UNPAs, as we called them, UNPAs. The intention was that UNPROFOR, the United Nations Protection Force, would secure the withdrawal of the JNA, that is to say the Yugoslav People's Army, from Croatia while providing protection to the inhabitants of the UNPAs and ensuring the removal and storage of heavy arms. Meanwhile, we would gradually restore normal economic and civil relations, rebuild an integrated police force, and secure the refugees to the protected areas. The idea was that we should do this from Sarajevo, Bosnia being seen by some as a peaceful oasis. The peacemaking role was to be conducted by the European Community through a conference chaired by Lord Carrington. Meanwhile, the UN would do the outdoor work and the heavy lifting. Though with hindsight, some of these elements seem a little bizarre, the negotiators may have felt that they had little room for maneuver given the political parameters they had to accept. The plan, I must say, showed considerably more optimism about the party's attitudes and intentions than UNPROFOR found either on arrival or indeed at any time thereafter. We found, on arrival in Sarajevo in mid-March 92, a sense of imminent doom, and were informed by the European negotiators who were in town that recognition of Bosnia-Herzegovina had been settled and was imminent. I recall that my friend General Philippe Morillon, Deputy Force Commander, and I had a memorably free and frank exchange of views with them shortly after our arrival in Sarajevo, where the Serbs were preparing for war. Their unwillingness to accept the integrated state of Bosnia-Herzegovina having been made clear some weeks earlier in a referendum. For our part, we had no mandate in Bosnia nor any troops. Indeed, infantry did not begin to arrive in Croatia until well after the Bosnian War had broken out. 3 weeks after our arrival in Sarajevo, the Serbs opened up on the city with heavy artillery. We had no functioning headquarters, no vehicles, no staff, no communications, no budget, no mandate. All of us were shelled out of our quarters, in my case, 3 times in 4 weeks, which I thought was excessive, but others fared even worse. We moved our headquarters in May to Belgrade and in July to Zagreb. In early June, rather to our surprise, the Bosnian Serbs agreed with me, after several days emotionally strenuous and extremely noisy negotiations with Dr. Karadzic, General Mladic, and Mrs. Biljana Plavcic, to hand over Sarajevo Airport to the United Nations for humanitarian aid. I tell you, I have never been so surprised in my life. Both parties, I had to rewrite all the cables to the Secretary General immediately. I've been forecasting absolute doom and disintegration in the negotiations that morning. Both parties immediately began to equivocate, however, which is much more like them, with infantry and heavy weapons, and equivocating with infantry and heavy weapons is some equivocating. And it took a dramatic visit to the airport by President Mitterrand to blast the agreement into operation. The first relief flights began almost immediately thereafter. The subsequent airlift has been the largest ever humanitarian undertaking and has rarely been other than extremely dangerous to all who have participated. The UN mandate was basically restricted in Bosnia over the next year to providing assistance to the UNHCR's remarkable program of humanitarian aid. The situation in Bosnia deteriorated steadily with vast numbers of refugees and displaced persons, great carnage and humanitarian outrages, mostly at the hands of the expansionist Serbs, and with widespread military activity, often directed against civilian populations, and involving all three main cultural groups, and with at least sporadic intervention, and support by both Serbian and Croatian armies. The Bosnian Serbs have retained the upper hand through most of the ensuing conflict, the Bosnian Croats gradually losing ground through most of 93 to resurgent government, mainly Muslim troops, until the adoption of the US brokered federation plan between Croat and government sides earlier this year. A number of so-called safe areas inhabited by Muslims were established by the Security Council in 1993 at Srebrenica, Garajde, Bihać, and so on. But they have always been extremely controversial because they were to be demilitarized on one side only, resembling a one-sided ceasefire in most of our military's experience, and some remained as major possible flashpoints, as we saw at the end of last year regarding Bihać. Kosovo, the Sanjak area of Serbia, the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, and the Vojvodine have been tense throughout much of the period, but have not, as has always been feared, exploded, and there has been little external military intervention in the former Yugoslavia as a whole, save, of course, for the activities of UNPROFOR in the territory, at times aided by NATO air power. All attempts to date by the various mediators and negotiators, the European Union was joined in its mediation efforts by the UN in the autumn of 1992, to achieve anything in the nature of a lasting settlement or more than interim ceasefires, have proved unsuccessful. The Security Council was, however, extremely active. During the first 2 years there, we had the experience and the benefit of more than 100 resolutions or presidential statements by the Council. From the UN standpoint, the main positive achievements should be mentioned. One, the conflict has been contained within a minority of the territory of former Yugoslavia and has not spread beyond it, as history shows Balkan wars usually do. Two, UNPROFOR secured the withdrawal of the JNA, the Yugoslav People's Army, from all of former Croatia, and the disarmament of the UN-protected areas, until a Croatian offensive into the Krajina, the Serb-held areas of Croatia, in January 1993, undid all UNPROFOR's modest achievements there. The Serbs went and took their arms back. 3. The joint UNPROFOR-UNHCR humanitarian endeavor in Bosnia has been extremely successful, though at a high cost in terms of human life and, of course, financially. And a recent World Health Organization survey and report confirm that nutritional and health standards in Bosnia remain in general high despite the conflict, and that the UN humanitarian effort has been the main cause. 4. The preventive peacekeeping operation in the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia has so far been very successful, though few of the underlying problems have yet been resolved, history again confirming just how intractable the issues there in Macedonia have been. The mandate which UNPROFOR was allowed to implement in regard to Macedonia related to threats, external threats to Macedonia, and essentially the concern was that there might be a southward shift by Serb troops which could destabilize the infant state. Macedonia, former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, has other international problems as well. What UNPROFOR was not allowed to do, and I know a little bit about this because I was partly responsible for setting this operation up, we were not allowed to deal with what we all knew was perhaps the most difficult problem in Macedonia, namely the internal mélange and relationships between majorities and minorities within Macedonia, which threatened, even by the end of 92 when we were involved in setting this up, already threatened to destabilize the region. Those situations have not been defused. It is not UNPROFOR's task to deal with that matter. It's not in our mandate, it's not in the UN's mandate to deal with those internal questions. And it's not, in fact, in UNPROFOR's mandate to do the peacemaking role in Macedonia. The Secretary General has sent Cy Vance back to Macedonia to try to achieve, to use good offices and try to achieve settlement. It is proving extremely difficult. There is also what used to be CSCE, now OSCE, mission in Macedonia, which has been very active. But this is a very difficult situation. At the moment, it is holding. 5, the international community has been stirred into establishing an international tribunal with jurisdiction over war crimes in ex-Yugoslavia, and events there and in Rwanda have stimulated a new interest on the part of the International Law Commission in creating a permanent international criminal court, an idea that has seen little governmental support since just after the end of the Second World War in Nuremberg, but which has always seemed to me, in any event, to be a necessary step in the advancement of international humanitarian law and the international rule of law generally. I hope Professor Higgins agrees with my supposition. And 6, there has, for the first time, been an effective and pioneering cooperation between the UN and NATO, the latter functioning in support of a peacekeeping operation and in accordance with Chapter 8 of the Charter. To go much further than this would, I think, be to trespass on the preserve of future historians. But they may judge that the UN's presence in ex-Yugoslavia has, to some degree, restrained conflict, casualties, destruction, horror, and misery, and that would certainly be my perception. But we could not be everywhere, and indeed the Council gave us no such authorization, even in its most expansive and exuberant mode, to which I shall return. And it is perhaps good that so quickly, after the naive euphoria of the immediate post-Cold War period, the attention of governments, soldiers, academics, and other specialists should have been brought back to earth and reality. The weaknesses in the international and European systems have been brutally spotlighted by the Yugoslav experience and by the media. And we may hope this may still stimulate early and effective remedial action. Though one should not perhaps be too sanguine. As Professor Eric Hobsbawm notes in my recent favorite piece of reading, his stimulating study on the 20th century, the century is ending with problems for which nobody has or even claims to have solutions. I quote, "For the first time in two centuries, the world of the 1990s entirely lacked any international system or structure. Where was the consortium of great powers which had once established, or at least formally ratified, disputed frontiers? What was the international political status of the new European Union, which aspired to a common political policy, but proved spectacularly incapable of even pretending to have one?" There are two different kinds of negative report cards on UNPROFOR in Yugoslavia. One refers to its failures to fulfill tasks it was mandated to fulfill and for which it was provided with adequate resources. The second negative assessment relates to its failure to do things which generous spirits would like it to have done in the way of ending the conflict, returning the displaced to their homes, quickly punishing the guilty, ruling with a rod of iron, and establishing respect for human rights, peace, and harmony in the Balkans. Some of these generous spirits also had their own political agendas. Some, especially among the media, and strong among those battalions of armchair strategists, would also have liked UNPROFOR to have destroyed the Bosnian Serb army and all its supporters. I very much hope to have time to come back later, maybe next lecture, to this question of public perception and expectation and of the power of the media, especially television. For it is both important and perplexing, the so-called CNN factor. UNPROFOR's major failures, I am not now speaking of the occasional outbreak of black marketeering or other scoundrelism, are more real and require more considered responses. What I consider to have been its major real failure so far is one that is scarcely ever mentioned by the media, and it shares responsibility for it with the international peacemakers in Geneva. I think that they have until recently paid insufficient focused attention to the situation in Croatia, despite relentless wailing on the part of UNPROFOR's succession of senior personnel, especially me. UNPROFOR has not so far succeeded in achieving a normalization between Croatian Croatia, or Croatian Croats, and Croatian Serbs in the Serb-held enclaves, though I was very pleased to read over Christmas that some progress may now be about to come about in the area of economic relations. Refugees have not returned. Indeed, there is still movement away from their homes by minorities in both Croat and Serb parts of Croatia. Each side are still exerting pressure upon their minorities. The ardor of intercommunal hatred, mistrust, and fear has not greatly subsided. It may take years. I must say, in my personal experience, I have never met anything quite so vitriolic as I have encountered in Croatia in that sense. Fear, based on fear on both sides. Indeed, disarmament has not been achieved, and it seems to me that unless the Croatian Serbs have some kind of cast-iron guarantee for their security, it's hard to see how this can be done except by force or through general and supervised disarmament for the whole of Croatia at least. It's always seemed to me to be a very weak point of the Vance plan that it expects some form of unilateral disarmament on the part of the minority Serbs faced by the Croats. I just think that's for the birds. But this is a very serious failure on UNPROFOR's part, and we all know the reasons for which all parties bear some responsibility. many have long believed that Croatia remains the most vulnerable and potentially explosive region of former Yugoslavia. If another war comes there, and all the elements are now present, both parties have armed themselves to the teeth, and both, I believe, are ready for a fight to the finish, and they mean it. It could have very far-reaching consequences. Second, insufficient stability has existed in Bosnia until now for many of the Council's resolutions to have been given effect, other than in regard to the delivery of humanitarian aid, and the Council's credibility has suffered through its being, for what felt like a long period in 92 to 93, somewhat out of touch with realities on the ground. The Council adopted resolutions really without reference to reports from those who were in a position to make an assessment. A mission to ex-Yugoslavia by some of its members in 93 was a rather useful corrective, UNPROFOR felt, but a little too fleeting and a little bit too late. I think these are the two main problems that have undermined UNPROFOR's achievement. I shall not attempt to list the imaginary failures of UNPROFOR, however vivid may have been the analysis and reportage of those who blame it for failing to do what the Council either did not ask it to do or did not give it the resources to do. Neither Europe nor the wider international community has been able to develop a consensus on what should be done in ex-Yugoslavia. Some options have been ruled out because of the size of the commitment that would be required to have any chance of success, and because, even then, the probability of success cannot be rated as very high. If the international community wants to impose a settlement on former Yugoslavia, then in my opinion, and I think I reflect the view of all our senior military personnel over the last two or three years, it must be prepared to muster resources on the scale of Desert Storm and be prepared for a wider conflagration and to remain there for some years. When I lived in Sarajevo in 1992, my Bosnian friends used to say, only the odd-numbered world wars begin in Sarajevo. Failing such an international commitment, the international community has de facto fallen back on three basic objectives: to contain the conflict, and above all, prevent it from spreading beyond the borders of former Yugoslavia; second, to provide as much humanitarian relief as has been possible in the circumstances; and thirdly, to make available their good offices. Each of these three objectives has been fulfilled. But the good offices' role has been much constrained by the absence of international consensus and the historical bitterness of the conflict. And as every negotiator knows, there is a time to fight, a time to study a problem, and a time to negotiate. This is not to say that a great deal cannot be learned so far from the tragedy of ex-Yugoslavia and the experience of UNPROFOR, which to a great extent has been made a scapegoat for other weaknesses in the international system. But perhaps the most important single lesson to be learned from Yugoslavia and Somalia, and indeed from the sad experience of the multinational force in Beirut in 83 to 84, is this. And I'm very pleased to see that the United Kingdom military have based their admirable new manual called Wider Peacekeeping on this dichotomy. Most important single lesson is this. Peacekeeping is peacekeeping, and enforcement is enforcement, and there are no such imaginary monsters as hybrid operations. They exist only in fairy tales and in the realms of wishful thinking. Nor does the United Nations have the ability to make both peace and war at the same time, in the same place, and with the same parties. On Monday, I will conclude these lectures by talking about peacekeeping in the 90s and beyond. I may need a full 55 minutes then, in which I would like to look at some of the underlying themes in international politics and relations and the development of institutional mechanisms, including peacekeeping. Thank you.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that we expected a lot, and Dr. Thornbury has given everything us tonight, everything that we expected. He has indicated once again that he's prepared to take a few questions. So the floor is yours. Can I have some questions?
I think it is an extremely serious situation which is now developing there. The Security Council has already asked President Tudjman to think again. And the Secretary General yesterday said that the UN would have to consider, if it did have to move out, whether it was possible for it to have its headquarters in Zagreb if it had no force there. We've had that experience once already. I'm very much afraid that if you pull the United Nations out of the United Nations protected areas, there will be an inexorable slide into, first of all, small-scale exchange of small arms fire and an escalation into the use of heavier guns. There will be attempts by local commanders to rationalize the front line, quote unquote. And we will fairly quickly, I'm afraid, see a return to major conflict. There have been, in 1993 already, two dreadful wars around Ukraine. In each occasion, the impatient Croats attacked the Serb-held areas, and in one case, the United Nations had to make up a dossier of allegations of what I would call, in lay terms, genocidal war crimes. And the degree of feeling and of fear on both sides is very great. The uncertain element, of course, in all this is the attitude of President Milosevic, and the extent to which the Krajina Serbs would enjoy or would be able to bring about support from Serbia. I think there's no question that they would get support from the Bosnian Serbs, although, in my opinion, Dr. Karadzic isn't particularly in love with the Krajina Serbs. General Mladic, Ratko Mladic, spent a lot of his time in Knin and has a very strong feeling for the Krajina Serbs, and I've seen him quite often in Knin. So my fear is that we would see an escalation into conflict, and both sides, as I said in my lecture, I think both sides are ready to fight to the finish. The Serbs can rocket Zagreb. I've actually been there when they've done it. Just one, just to show. And there is no question that the Croatian army is vastly stronger than it was a couple of years ago. Nobody seems to have been very much interested in the arms embargo in regard to Croatia, which has always puzzled me a little bit. But in any event, the Croatian army is a much more viable entity than it was in 1991, early 92. I think it is a situation of the greatest gravity. And I very much hope that at the end of the day, it is, as some people have suggested, a negotiating mechanism on the part of Professor Tudjman as well, President Tudjman, and that he will be persuaded to see reason. I understand his concern and his frustration and his impatience. No one could not do. Croatia is a state which is on the rack at the moment. It's geographically and logistically very much disadvantaged by the current situation, and it has hundreds of thousands of refugees in its territory, and it is suffering economically. But I'm afraid that if the UN is pulled out, even though the UN has not fulfilled all its tasks in the UNPAS, it has maintained a degree of stability while the peacemakers look for a settlement. I would like to see that situation continue, and I would like to see the peacemakers redouble their efforts. It's a very good question. We did have human rights monitors around. They were excellent. We maintained them in a high degree of autonomy. I'm not being diplomatic, that's not a negative thing to say. We saw them all the time. I mean, they used to come into my office all the time to talk to me about what was going on and what they were doing. But we did not bring them under our authority. I didn't make any attempt to tell them what to do. I wouldn't have wanted to. Because I do think that if it was there, it was in the essence of their task to have that level of autonomy. So far as I'm concerned, I agree with the hypotheses of your question, or what I think are the implicit hypotheses. Our police were damn good in Croatia on this matter. But they didn't have a mandate to go anywhere else very much, although we were actually pushing them out into Bosnia. I had them in Mostar with me at one point, and so on. So yes, I think that a human rights component would have been excellent. What is very important with human rights monitors is that they are practical people. They must be practical people. This is the advantage of the police. Because, you know, there are very often 10 different ways of skinning a cat, they say, well, they said where I come from anyway. Not a very nice metaphor. But, and you don't have to get formal compliance with certain things in order to get effective improvement. So I think that is the one reservation I have. I would like to know where those human rights monitors are coming from, what their training is, what their background is, and who's going to run them. Because otherwise they could be an absolute loose cannon. Well, I can simply tell you from my experience, it was in very effective cooperation. I worked, for example, personally myself and one of our military planners worked with NATO to work out a completely integrated operational plan for the implementation of any peace agreement in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And it was an extremely rewarding experience to work with real professionals, I must tell you. I mean, really very, very satisfying experience. I think there was a little local difficulty in regard to the attempted or desired or telegraphed proposed airstrikes in regard to Bihać. There were a lot of political problems going on, and a lot of people had their own agendas, and they had their own problems with this or that or another element in their own state. It's not for NATO to take policy decisions. And to go in and bomb one side, not in self-defense, but basically to make you feel better, feel-good bombing. Pretty political thing to do. So I was a little bit surprised when I saw the new Secretary General of NATO making some of the rather strong statements that he did, but he doesn't seem to have been making them anymore, and everybody seems to have sort of settled down, and Michael Rose will be glad to get out on the 24th of January anyway.
We have one more.
I was got into trouble in Croatia for telling people what I thought ought to be done on this. because everybody immediately ganged up and jumped on me. The problem about Croatia is it is exceedingly difficult at this point in time to get a proposal which does not trespass upon what each side deems to be its vital interests. And they are still so inflamed that it's very difficult to talk to them, to talk them down off the wall. And in any event, let's face it, the Serbs in Croatia are not going to want to make up their mind, are not going to want to take a final decision in regard to their future until they see what's going to happen with Bosnia and the relationship between Bosnia, Serb, and Serbia. I mean, you know, the idea of a greater Serbia is by no means dead, any more than the idea of a greater Albania is dead or the idea of a greater Croatia is dead. They're all there, all those ideas. I think that at the end of the day there will have to be some form of internationally controlled demilitarization of both Serb and Croat sides in Croatia, and I think that there will have to be, I believe, that there will have to be probably a confederal solution. I think it is the only way in which you're going to get it's the only compromise that can be made, but at the moment it's an unacceptable compromise to both sides. But I think that I believe the negotiators have to go on along that track, and I think that they have to ad interim, in any event, head off any action which looks as if it is aimed at creating a greater Serbia, because that is certainly not timely. Yes, it's one. Confederal, I think, even. Fewer now. I, if I may say so, I agree with a very great deal of what you say. I have found frequently that President Izetbegovic is probably the most moderate and practical of the leaders in that area. I think it would be an overstatement to say that I am cheerfully recommending what I was suggesting in regard to Croatia. It is a question of a last resort. And the problem is, sir, whether the Serbs in Croatia are I've forgotten what the adjective you used was, but whether they're extremist or I've forgotten what the word was, fanatic, they are nevertheless entitled to life, and there are a lot of fanatical people who still enjoy democratic rights and whose positions have to be taken into consideration. I know, but...
Serbian priest, Serbian bishop who gathered at liturgy in France.
Yes.
President Tuchman congratulated Serbs on their Christmas in France. Serbs are voting normally like any other citizen, 400,000 Serbs, 200,000 fanatics.
Sir, I think we must differ on certain points. May I just say this final word, and forgive me if I abuse my position by taking the final words. There are as many Serbs who have become refugees from Croatia as there are Croats who have become refugees from the Serb-held parts of Croatia. The numbers are almost exactly the same if you look at the High Commissioner for Refugees statistics, and those refugees are still coming on both sides, not only on one, but on both sides. Forgive me, but we have a difference of emphasis.
I would say that this is consequent of the policies of the international powers, including U.S.
I think I'm afraid I must draw the proceedings to an end, but Dr. Thornbury, I think we none of us could say that your conclusions aren't somber, but what you have done is to make it manifestly clear that there is a tremendous amount of work and hard thinking to be done about the future of peacekeeping, and we look forward very much to your own views on that on Monday evening.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.